begin a new series with this Advent season. And the title of the series is taken from text from Matthew. And over the course of it, we'll be looking at Matthew chapters 1 and 2 and the story that Matthew shares with us with regard to the birth of Jesus. It wasn't too long ago that we studied through Luke's gospel from beginning to close, and during that time utilized the story, which is perhaps even more familiar to most, from Luke chapter 2 as the beginning point of that series. This one's quite unique and different, and it begins also with a genealogy. The title of the series for this Advent season is His Name is Jesus. So we will remember that from the words that the angel spoke to Joseph and instructed him that his name would be Jesus. It means salvation, and it offers hope. And so that's the series title. Today, though, when we look at Matthew chapter 1, we find that what is revealed through this genealogy is the promise of a king. And so the promise of a king is the focus of our attention today. Let me read the genealogy to you, beginning with verse 1 of chapter 1 in Matthew's gospel. It says, "The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. And Judah the father of Perez and Zerah by Tamar, and Perez the father of Hezron. And Hezron the father of Ram, and Ram the father of Amminadab. And Amminadab the father of Nahshon, and Nahshon the father of Salmon. And Salmon the father of Boaz by Rahab, and Boaz the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David, the king, and David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. And Solomon, the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam, the father of Abijah, and Abijah, the father of Asaph. And Asaph, the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat, the father of Joram, and Joram, the father of Uzziah. And Uzziah, the father of Jotham, and Jotham, the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh, the father of Amos. And Amos, the father of Josiah. And Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers at the time of the deportation to Babylon. And after the deportation to Babylon, Jeconiah was the father of Shealtiel. And Shealtiel, the father of Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel, the father of Abihud. And Abihud, the father of Eliakim. And Eliakim, the father of Azor, and Azor, the father of Zadok, and Zadok, the father of Achim, and Achim, the father of Eliud, and Eliud, the father of Eleazar, and Eleazar, the father of Mathan, and Mathan, the father of Jacob, and Jacob, the father of Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David were 14 generations, and from David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations, and from the deportation to Babylon to the Christ, 14 generations. Now, if you read this and you think to yourself, this is mind-numbing. I don't know how you can maintain your focus and attention through all of that melee of names that are so foreign to us and difficult to pronounce. But the reality is that what we're describing is family. And it's a family of which we are a part. So there is a purpose in this description. If we were to go back and read through this more carefully, you would find that as it begins with Abraham, it climaxes at the center point with David. Now you would think, no, it climaxes at the end with Jesus. And certainly that is true, but David is where Jesus is first introduced. When we see the covenant that is made with Abraham, it is a covenant that God is going to take him out of a distant land. He's going to bless him and make him a nation. And then through that nation, he's going to bless all the other nations. But when we get to David, we find that the description that is given of the renewal of that same covenant that passes down from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob, then to Joseph, and then to Moses, from Moses then ultimately to David. And David comes back into the picture in Matthew's gospel as he describes this. And what we find is that over and over God tells David that his throne, his kingdom will be forever. None of the descendants of David would ever be able to maintain anything that would even resemble the description. So it tells us that there's more to come, and that the promised king that God assured David would reign on his throne is still yet to be until we get to the end. And we see that from the house and the lineage of David is born in humility and humble circumstances the one who will become the king. The promise of a king began long before Jesus was born. Now, what do we learn from all of this? We're going to look at several things, but before we do, by way of introduction, let me say this to all of us. I believe that the covenant that is described for us and referenced, or at least implied, through the genealogy is a reminder to us of something more than just a promise. If the covenant is true and can be traced through the ages, as it certainly can be, then what we discover is that God has moved through the ages with purpose. Now, if you think about that in relationship to the culture that we live in today, we are taught and led to believe that the world is random, and that events and circumstances that take place have no defined purpose or predefined purpose. So that everything is just happening as it happens, and that we are literally shaping the future. But I propose that is not the case. I believe in a very God-centered worldview by which we understand the world not as random but as ordered. And that even in the midst of the order of God, while it may seem that chaos is taking place, we are reminded that from the very beginning that God moved across the face of the chaotic world and he spoke light and life and order into it. And nothing that you or I have done or can do will ever disrupt or destroy that which God has determined. Celebration of the birth of Jesus is the fulfillment of a promise that began long ago, goes back even before Abraham. If you go back to the fall of man and you read in chapter 3 of Genesis of the sinfulness and the rebellion that takes place in Adam and Eve, it is upon the pronouncement of the curse of their sin that God also pronounces the promise of the coming of one who would crush the head of evil. Purpose has always been here. What does that mean for you and me? It means that you are purposeful and purposefully defined, designed, and created. Your life has meaning. Every life has meaning. When we put value back into the experience, and when we understand that there is value and significance that extends beyond everything that you and I see or touch or know, then it reminds us and teaches us that God is sovereign in all these things. Recent conversations over theology have brought me to a greater awareness of how God has worked in my life over the course of the years of serving in this role as pastor. I began with a fairly free sense of understanding about who we are and how things unfold. I wouldn't say that I was 100% on board with the whole concept of free will. I've always believed in responsibility, but I've also always understood that the decisions that I make are influenced by external sources that I don't control. So it's hard to say that any choice that we make is ever free entirely. But along the way, I found that relying upon self and depending on a world that is broken and hoping for something better out of all of this is a bit of a fool's errand. And that ultimately our hope must be centered in something more than the circumstances in which we live, and it must be centered more than our own self-determination. Our hope must be grounded in a grace that extends beyond us. And it must come from a God who is sovereign over us. I don't need God to support me. I need God to rule me. And so sovereignty is where I've landed. Dependence by faith in that which God alone has created and caused, has given renewed energy and direction for my life, so that I rest by faith in the purpose of God, believing that there is nothing in the world in which we live, nor in what is to come, nor in me that can undo that which Christ has caused. By His grace. I need that. It gives me an anchor point. It gives me a solid footing and foundation. And it provides for us a hope that extends beyond all of this. Christmas then becomes about purpose. And purpose rests entirely in the control of God. Let me share with you just a couple of things still in the introduction, and then I'll quit with that. And we'll look at this in more detail. First of all, when we hear that Abraham is the very center and beginning of that genealogy, let me read something to you from Genesis 12:1. It says, "The Lord said to Abram, 'Go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you, and I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed.'" It is a powerful passage that we read because it is the beginning of something very new for the people of that day. And it reminds us that God began long ago to accomplish that which we realize in Jesus Christ. That Jesus Christ has so influenced and transformed our lives that who we are today is the direct result of what began then. It connects us to all of the things of God, and it connects us to all of the calling of God, and it helps us to see that we are part of a much larger plan that is moving inevitably to its conclusion and finality with the return of Jesus Christ. So we see ourselves involved and engaged in the mission of God and the purpose of God, but to what extent and in what way? Can we learn from this genealogy? Can we learn from the people of this genealogy who we are supposed to be today? I think we can. And Abraham helps us to do that as the Bible describes for us his calling. First of all, notice that the promise of the king began with the provision of salvation. Provision of salvation. Salvation that is spoken of here is seen in Abraham. You say, well, wait a minute, salvation is something that doesn't come till later. No, salvation has always been a part of what God has been doing. In fact, we know that when Abraham trusted God and believed him by faith, that God reckoned to him that faith for his righteousness. Salvation has always been about those who trust in God by faith. But what about Abraham? We read about him that he was a man who lived in a distant land, that he worshipped foreign gods and pagan gods, that he was a man who was broken and lost and destitute. And it was in the midst of all of this destitution and all of this lostness that God called him and said, Abraham, leave this land and go where I will show you. Salvation begins with a call from God by which he calls us out of our darkness and then leads us where he wants us to go. Salvation is being described here in the call of Abraham. It's not just about relocation. It is about transformation. It is about salvation. You say, you mean I can't be a Christian and just stay the way I am? I say you can't. I say you can't. Well, I like the way I am. Then you don't really want Christ. You just want a designation. There are lots of other designations that you can hold that will make people think well of you. You can be a good person. You can be a good leader. You can be a philanthropist. You can be charitable and merciful and giving. You can do all kinds of things in this world that will produce good results and will benefit others and will make for you a name that others will remember at least for maybe a generation. But transformation is something that takes place as the result of genuine salvation. So that if you want just a designation on the outside of your life, then you don't understand the true nature of the salvation that takes place inside the life. When Abraham was called out of his land and his unbelief, God was working in him to do a number of things, a whole list of things. In fact, if we were to go through it in great detail. But it all happens in seemingly one moment. It's kind of the way it happens for most of us as well. We come to the realization that what we are doing in the life we are living is not what God has called us to, and there is no satisfaction or peace in it. There's a disturbance within us that results in this chaos and confusion that seems to give us a sense of fear and uncertainty. We realize that we are sinners and that because of that sin we are under judgment. And because of that judgment we are cut off from the blessing of God and the fulfillment of who we are truly made to be. It is in that moment of awareness that we cry out to God and we cry out for forgiveness and we cry out for redemption. And God blesses with faith to believe Him and to trust in Him that what He has done through Jesus Christ is sufficient to deliver us from that sinfulness so that we are now established and we repent of that sin, turning away from it, and we now follow Him. Remember what Jesus said when He went to the disciples. Those who would become disciples, he went to them as they were fishing. He went to them as they were collecting taxes. He went to them as they were going about their daily lives and experience. And he said, come, follow me. Leave your fishing, leave your business, leave your tax collecting, and follow me. Over and over, the call of God begins with a call away from something in order to prepare us to go to something. It isn't just about geography or location. It is about who He has made us to be and transformation. Abraham was called out of Haran and he was to go to a land that he didn't know about that God would show him as he went. And along the way would help him to understand what all of this means. But the bottom line is that when we look back at the covenant with Abraham, we see the very essence of the salvation and grace that you and I would come to realize through Jesus Christ. While this progressive revelation of God has given us additional information through the ages so that we understand it more completely today than Abraham would have understood it then, it's the same God, it's the same grace, it's the same calling, it's the same salvation. The purpose of God has not veered from the path, nor has it changed throughout all of these generations. That means that it will not change for you or I until Jesus comes again. we have purpose, salvation. He said to Abraham, not only would he call him out of this land and send him to a land and establish him there that he was going to show him, but he said, I will bless you and make of you a great nation. The promise to Abraham involved not only salvation, but also security. Security is something that we struggle with. And it's something that I think all of us, at some point or another, really need to come to grips with. So are you insecure? Well, the answer is immediately yes. Everybody, to one degree or another, is insecure. Those who would say they're not insecure are either just so incredibly deceived that they don't see it at all or just refuse to, or they're just dumber than a bag of rocks. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a dangerous place to be. It is either arrogance in the extreme to deny this, or it is ignorance beyond the pale. Insecurity is a reality that we all deal with, and one that drives much of what we do and the way we go about it. And we need to be aware of it so that it affects not only our relationships with other people, but it directly affects our relationship with God. Insecurity is the fear that drives many people away from God, causes us to find other ways to accommodate the need that we all feel within and the emptiness that we are all drawn to. Insecurity is something that keeps many people trapped and snared and eats away at the very foundation of their psyche and their soul to the point where they literally lose themselves in this process. What he said to Abraham was, I will make of you a nation. I will bless you. Now, he didn't say, if you do this and you do that and you do the other thing, then I will bless you. There was no condition involved here. It was a statement that I will bless you because I have chosen you. No other reason but that. The same thing still exists today. We are blessed not because we deserve it. We are blessed not because we have earned it. We are blessed because He has chosen to bless us. It is utterly and entirely the work of God. That either makes you worshipful or it makes you resentful. There's really not much in between. You say, well, why would somebody be resentful of grace? Many people resent a gift. They resent it. Why? Because it reminds them that they don't deserve it. And again, it starts to eat away at that foundation of insecurity that they've grown comfortable with. And so people will refuse the gift in order to avoid any sense of beholding to the giver. And we do the same thing with God. God's just trying to get in my pocket. God's just trying to get in my schedule. God's just trying to take me away from the things that I love. So along the way, we are deceived and persuaded and convinced that we love the things that are actually destroying us, when in reality we do not love them, and they never provide us with peace or security, and they never give us any sense of satisfaction. We return time and again to an empty well, and we pull up an empty bucket, and we pretend that we have water, and it's no different than a grandchild's tea party. It's still empty, and it's fake. It may be fun for the moment, but there's no satisfaction. But we're not children playing tea. We're adults. They're supposed to be living life. God called Abraham. He said, I will bless you and I will make of you something that you could never make of yourself. He was saying to him, I'm going to provide you what you need, but you have to learn to trust me. You have to rest in what I give you so that you can know beyond any measure of doubt that you are safe and you are secure, not because of what you have done, not because of what others say about you, but because of what I have done. Security that we have in the grace of Jesus Christ not only anchors us in this life, but assures us that what comes from this life will also equally be directed by God. We so desperately want to control and manage the world around us in order to protect ourselves and those we love. And the reality is we do not possess that control, nor are we capable of such things, so that if we insist on it, we will drive ourselves insane in the effort to try to manage something unmanageable. But if, on the other hand, we can learn to rest in that which God has done and has been doing for so long, we will find a peace and a security that will release us not only to love, but to be loved. Not only to be a blessing or to be blessed, but also to become a blessing. This second phase is vitally important to our understanding of what Christ is doing in our lives today. He has saved us, yes, but He also secures us, so that we read passages that remind us that those that Jesus holds in His hand cannot be taken from it, reminds us that that which He has done will continue until it is completed, so that we have this hope. Christmas is a celebration of Jesus, who is the realization of the promise of a king and is the promise of salvation and security and finally servanthood. He said to Abraham, I will bless you, take you out of this land of chaos, confusion, and falsehood. I will bless you and make of you a nation. And then I will take you and that nation and I will bless all the nations of the earth, so that you will be a blessing. Servanthood. Servanthood. If this is just about what God does for me, then that's selfishness. If, on the other hand, what God does in me, He does in me in order to do the same thing and more through me, now it's servanthood. The fulfillment and realization of servanthood is something that only comes through the understanding of a very fundamental principle. It doesn't mean anything until it means something to you. I have a grandson who likes tractors. Every boy at one point or another likes tractors. And what's not to like? The only thing that makes a tractor bigger, better, is if you can make it bigger. I saw a tractor the other day that had tracks that stood taller than my truck. And there were four of them. And as I drove by it, all I could think about was, I wonder if the keys are in it. But looking at a tractor only creates longing. Driving a tractor creates satisfaction. I remember the first time that I got on the tractor and I put Caleb in my lap and we started down the road. And the delight and joy, it was slightly raining and it was really cold and neither of us cared. I have a picture that the kids took of us sitting on the tractor, sitting on my desk to commemorate the moment. But what I am reminded of in that moment was when we got out to the gravel road out of the driveway from the farm, I said, you drive it. And he took hold of the wheel and he started steering as we went down the road. He didn't stay in the track and he needed some adjustment and help. But for crying out loud, he was 4 years old. And the joy and the grip on that wheel was just beyond anything else. I remember the joy and satisfaction that came from that. You see, looking at a tractor, riding on a tractor is one thing. Driving it, that's where it becomes real. It's true in all of our experiences. All of you who post your pictures of the meals that you're enjoying and how beautiful they are and how wonderful they look, that's all great and it looks great. But you're not bringing me samples. And without samples, I can't verify what my eyes are seeing. For all I know, that's made out of glue. The Bible understood this too, so that the psalmist said it this way when he said, taste and see the Lord is good. You got to know it for yourself. Salvation and security calls us to servanthood, and in serving by the same standard by which we have been saved and set apart. By serving, we are expressing that which is who we really are. Servanthood is not an obligation, it isn't a duty, it isn't a function to be fulfilled or a task to be performed. It is an identity to be lived out. Jesus said, "I did not come to be served, I came to serve." He didn't come to do something, he came to demonstrate something. Jesus said to Peter when he washed the feet of the disciples and Peter refused, he said, "Unless I wash your feet as well, you have no part in me. Unless you receive the servant ministry that I am providing, you will not understand and experience what it means to be a servant to someone else. But you will always, having had that experience, have the image of the very Messiah of the universe washing your feet, showing you servanthood." God has called us to serve. He has secured us so that we can. He has saved us to transform us into our truest selves and our highest identity. With regard to all of this, we see then that the genealogy that is described for us in Abraham and then later in David and all of the people in between is a reminder to us that God has a purpose and a plan that works out through all the generations. Just as it did leading up to Jesus, so it is also doing from that point forward. And you and I are a part of that, so that we are all a part of what God is doing in a very purposeful, sovereignly directed experience that will find its fulfillment in the return of Christ. This is our hope. John Piper said this with regard to that. He said that the conditionality of the covenant is repeated again and again in Kings and Chronicles. David tells Solomon that God said, "If your sons take heed to their ways to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and soul, there shall not fail you a man on the throne of Israel." It means that as long as David's sons are disobedient, the kingdom cannot be made secure forever. But then we look at 1 Kings 8, where Solomon prays, "Lord God of Israel, keep with thy servant David, my father, what you have promised him, saying, there shall never fail you a man before me to sit upon the throne of Israel." The promise was given forever and forever and forever. God said, "I will make someone to sit." The promise is fulfilled not in all of that, but it is fulfilled in Jesus. When the angel Gabriel appeared to Mary in Luke 1:31 through 33, "Behold, you will conceive in your womb, bear a son. You shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." Therefore, beyond any shadow of a doubt, the Bible teaches that the promise to David that his descendant would rule forever is fulfilled in Jesus Christ as the Son of David, as the Lord of David. Jesus now reigns as King in heaven over the true house of Israel. God promised us a king. Jesus is that King. God called us out of chaos to purpose, and He's still doing it today.